We have reached our destination. It's like we've been on a journey or a pilgrimage, and we've reached the destination of our pilgrimage, which is prajna, wisdom, or penetration, is how Subhuti translates prajna. So last night, Prajnanita told us about the fourth of the intensifiers, absorption. And we've built up to absorption, haven't we, through engagement, a heartfelt engagement, or in interest and emotional engagement, leading into resolve, into conviction, commitment, leading into attentiveness, an intense attentiveness, which flourishes or flowers out into absorption, if you like. Quoting, if I can remember his name now, D.H. Lawrence, us in our wholeness, wholly attending. Us in our wholeness, wholly attending. It's like with absorption, we're all together. Our energies are harmonized. We're going and flowing in a single direction. And we maintain that kind of laser-like focus on the object of concentration, and our attention flowers out through that, the power of that attention. It flowers into prajna. And prajna is penetration. So let's run with Subhuti's translation of penetration. It's penetration to the depths. This, at its most complete, is, if you like, the whole culmination and purpose of meditation. So it's truly our destination on this pilgrimage. But it's not an all or nothing quality, or state of mind, this prajna. You may well be familiar with the different levels of prajna, different levels of wisdom. Wisdom, of course, is another translation for prajna, penetration. The first level being receptivity, or listening, openness, where we take things as we hear them, as we read them, on trust, if you like, from the wise. We listen to the wise and we take on board what they say. And maybe it's because they're qualified. We respect them. And that could be a driving instructor or a gym instructor. We reckon they know what they're talking about. We reckon they're qualified. We hear what they say and we like it, and it seems to make sense, and we put it into practice. We believe what they say, don't we? We believe a lot of, all through our lives, we're believing this so much. We're taking so much on trust, the wise words of people who are qualified. But we accept kind of provisionally, I suppose, really, until we try them out, test them out. Test them in the laboratory of our own experience. And that's the second level of wisdom, which is reflecting, thinking, and trying out in our own lives, applying in our own lives, in the context of our particular circumstances, including discussion with our friends, helping us to reflect and ponder on a particular teaching. Again, whether it's a fitness regime or the Dharma. So we're testing with our reason. We're saying, yes, does this make sense? On the basis of my understanding of the world, does this teaching make sense? Does it add up? And we try it out. That's the beauty of at least the Dharma. It's so practical. We can test it out. And that's an invitation that Buddhism offers. The Buddha says, just try this out. The whole Dharma is placed in is offered as an invitation, to try out the teachings and see if they work in our own lives. It's about making the teachings our own. Do they result in benefit and happiness? That's the criteria that the Buddha suggests we apply. Try his teachings. Do they result in benefit and happiness? If yes, go run with them. If not, try something else. So at this stage, we're going beyond belief. We're making the teachings our own. We've proved them. in the crucible of our own lives, and we can see they work, but we continue with them and we go deeper with the truths. And this is where penetration comes in. This is the third level of wisdom, penetration. So with concentrated mind, backed up by our integrated energies, as Pranyanit was describing yesterday with absorption, if you like, energies that are purified of greed and hatred. So I use that metaphor, didn't I, of absorption being, if you like, the laser beam attention that cuts through. It's like another metaphor is obviously a sharp knife, sharp sword. So through our absorption, through our calm abiding, our harmonized energies, the hindrances fall away. Greed, hatred, delusion, dullness, restlessness, doubt. We transcend them. We see the world more objectively and not through those lenses of what's in it for me. Or I don't like that, I don't want that, away with it. If we progress with our practice, we can achieve states of meditation like the dhyanas, which are one model or one description of the absorbed mind. And then the first dhyana, we're still capable of discursive thought. We're still capable of reflection. So thinking has not completely fallen away. It's far more concentrated. It's that laser light focus because the distractions have ceased. With the falling away of the hindrances like greed and hatred, and we know how powerful those hindrances are in terms of distraction. With them falling away, we can really get to the depths of whatever it is we're reflecting on without distortion, Wordsworth gives a good description of this kind of vision, this penetrating vision. To quote from some lines composed above Tintern Abbey, that serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul, while with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things. So that's what meditation, absorption, dhyanas open up to us, particularly the first dhyana, seeing into the life of things. That's what this penetration is about. It's like a penny drops. We get an intuitive grasp of what it is we're attending to, like the breath. And the reality, the experience of that reality, which is beyond words, it's kind of assimilated into the depths of our being. So we're going deeper into the object, but we're going deeper into our own depths. And this is what Pranyanit was describing yesterday with absorption. It's like the object of attention becomes more subtle and we become more subtle. And it's like there's this gradual coming together. The distance between perceiver and perceived reduces until with penetration, with wisdom at its highest level, we see beyond the dualism, that we see beyond this sense of self and other, and there's a unification or just a transcending of the duality. So this is the goal of Buddhism. We're talking about an elevated state of consciousness here. The whole of the spiritual life, this is from Subhuti, the whole of the spiritual life as conceived by Buddhism can be represented in terms of the intensifiers culminating in prana. So this road that we've been on, this pilgrimage of the intensifiers from emotional engagement to prana, in one sense, is the journey of Buddhism. Another translation for prana is transcendental insight. Transcendental insight. So what do we mean by transcending? Again, you could say it's about cutting through. It's partly about the object of our intention. So up until this point, up until penetration, up until prana, up until transcendental insight, that the object that we're attending to is distorted. We're not seeing the real thing. We're seeing something that's more or less like the real thing, perhaps. But we have a false idea of the object. And traditionally, there are two ways of looking at how we distort the object. The metaphor of veils is used. There are two veils that cover the object of our attention, that get between us and the object of attention. And the first is the veil of impurity. It's described as the impure. And it's all about what I was talking about a couple of minutes ago. The unskillful emotions, the hatred, greed, those first two of the hindrances, and all that world of likes and dislikes. It's like we see the object through the lens of our likes and dislikes, of what we want and don't want. So we see it through our distorted will and project that onto the object. But this veil of impurity, as it's described, falls away once we reach the pinnacle of absorption. So the first four of the intensifiers strip away this veil of impurity that distorts the object of our attention, whatever that is, whether it's the breath or ourselves. There's a second veil, and the second veil is the veil of views. It's described. So we had the veil of impurity, and this is the veil of views. And it's about, the veil of views is about egotistical interpretation. So seeing the world in terms of what's in it for me. How does it relate to me? Is it praising me? Is it blaming me? Is it helping me? Is it hindering me? It's all about me. And this is described as kind of a bit more subtle, this veil, whereas the veil of impurity is a more gross veil. This is seen as a more subtle one that takes longer to break through. And it's only really with this stage, the final stage of the fourth, the fifth of the intensifiers. It's only at this stage that this veil is removed. It is stripped away by prana. So we see through this distinction between self and other. So we just transcend the sense of the ego, and are seeing the world through that lens. And this expresses itself naturally. Once we break down the distinction between self and other, we naturally behave. We naturally cherish others as ourselves. There's no distinction between self and other, and we see others as vivid in their reality as ourselves. So, yeah, this is going towards the Bodhisattva ideal, the pinnacle of expression of compassionate, appropriate action on the basis of insight into how things really are. One way of looking at transcendental insight is to see it as countering what are called the topsy-turvy views. It's another way, another angle in on this concept of transcendental insight or prana. We are constantly making mistakes. On this side of enlightenment, this side of prajna, this side of transcendental insight, we're constantly seeing the impermanent as though it were permanent. Now, you know, intellectually we know all these things around me, they're going to end. We know that intellectually. But what's our emotional attitude towards these things around me? You know, when yesterday I broke a little lovely little bowl through an accident. When we break things, when we lose things, and feel that the loss, you know, what's that showing us? It's showing that there was some kind of attachment, as though the attachment really betrays a sense of actually that will last. So, you know, why, I suppose the question is, why are we surprised when something breaks? Why are we surprised when we lose something? We know things are impermanent. We know they can't last forever. The second topsy-turvy view, so that was the first, seeing the impermanent as permanent. The second is seeing the insubstantial as substantial. So whether it's ourselves, with our sense of me and mine, as though it's something fixed, we stick a label on, and the label suggests, you know, I'm Ratnadeva. Ratnadeva tomorrow still sounds like Ratnadeva, and the next day it'll still sound like Ratnadeva. So the label isn't changing, and I think, yeah, I'm substantial. I'm something that continues. I can describe it day after day, the same thing. And others, you know, so ourselves we see as substantial, and we see others are substantial. And that there's an interesting, there's kind of a contradiction going on there. We get a kind of a niggling feeling that actually doesn't quite ring true, because, you know, we stick these labels on all the objects around us, and yet we see nothing is stable. We see everything is in flow. So there's kind of this contradiction between one part of our mind sticking on labels to its heart's content, And another part of our brain is saying, hold on, but it's changing. That's all changing. There's no part of my experience where I can't see change. But that's another story. That's another whole retreat, probably. So that's the second of the topsy-turvy views. The third is seeing the painful as pleasurable. And, you know, this, you can say, is the area of false refuges. Finding ease in what is inseparable from suffering, that's Kanza. Finding ease in what is inseparable from suffering. David Foster Wallace, I love this quote from David Foster Wallace. If you worship money and things, the false refuges, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power. You will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart. You will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. It's a beautiful evocation of false refuges, seeing what is painful as pleasurable. So we're looking at meditation, meditation that gives the knowledge of the nature of reality, prajna. So what is the nature of reality? How do we describe the nature of reality? Well, one way of describing the nature of reality, the Buddhism offers quite a few, but one of them, which is really central in the teaching, is the marks of existence. The lakshanas, that is what they're called. And there are three marks of existence. They are impermanence, non-self or insubstantiality, and unsatisfactoriness. And, well, impermanence, yes, almost hardly need to say any more. What I will do with these three Lakshanas. I'll do a reflection on them. This morning I'll do a meditation stroke reflection on the three Lakshanas, and I'll draw out some of the qualities, some of the ramifications of the Lakshanas, impermanence, insubstantiality, and unsatisfactoriness. This teaching on the intensifiers and the meditation that is that is penetration is an invitation to meditate, contemplate the Lakshanas to an extent where our meditation goes deeper into a particular type of meditation, depending on which of the Lakshanas we're meditating on. So, for example, impermanence. We meditate on and contemplate impermanence to a point where we reach what's called the samadhi, or absorption of the signless, sometimes called the imageless. So it's a particular nuance to our meditation, a very deep meditation. So impermanence suggests that, you know, things cannot be pinned down. So in this deeper state of meditation, we no longer feel the need to pin things down. We no longer feel the need to label things. We're content with a direct experience of the world. So impermanence opens out into this meditation state, the signless meditation state. Similarly, contemplating non-self opens out into a meditation, a samadhi, an absorption that is openness, sometimes described as shunya or shunyata, emptiness. I like to use the eddy, the image of the eddy, to try and draw out some of the ramifications of the state of shunyata. So, you know, an eddy in a stream, you look at an eddy in a stream, and it's constantly changing. It's, you know, the water is flowing through it. It's an entity in itself, and it seems to have some form of stability, and yet, you know, the water is constantly flowing through it. That's one aspect of the eddy, but there's another interesting one, which is it doesn't have any boundaries between it and the river. So it's like it's in continuity with the river. There's no point around the eddy where you can say, the eddy stops here and the river starts. It is the river is the eddy. So this state of shunyata is a state of meditation, deep meditation, where we realize that continuity, that intimate connection, the non-separation, the lack of a boundary. So shunyata, sometimes, as it says, translated as emptiness, and that means emptiness of a kind of fixity, emptiness of a boundary, and emptiness of a limitation. So shunya can also be just as easily, it's really funny, I think, this, that shunyata can be translated on the one hand as emptiness, and on the other hand as fullness. You know, that boundlessness, that's surely that openness, that's a fullness. And of course we have the image that we heard in the reading this morning from Pranyanita of the blue sky as a way of drawing out the ramifications of openness, of shunyata, you know, the image of this limitless blue sky, spotless, pure. So we often talk of reality as a blue sky, pure. It's unspoilt by any fixity. It's open, limitless. That's the absorption of shunyata. So the third absorption, which is a deepening of our contemplation of unsatisfactoriness or dukkha, is the called the wishless samadhi or absorption. Wishless are unbiased. And in this state, there's just no tendency towards our way from any object of our experience. There's kind of an equanimity. There's, I have a friend, Sangadeva, he was in IKEA once, and he had this big smile on his face going around the labyrinth that IKEAs tend to be. You might have thought, oh, he's seen something that he really wants. He's seen just what he needs. Ah, that's why he's got the smile on his face. But no, ask him, what is it you've seen, Sangadeva? And he says, there's absolutely nothing here that I want. I don't need a single thing from this whole store. He was so delighted with that. You know, he felt so free not to need a single thing. That's pointing in the direction, I think, of this wishless or unbiased state of absorption that comes from contemplating unsatisfactoriness, dukkha. You feel, there's nothing lacking. I have everything that I need. This is where we approached yesterday. I have everything that I need in this moment right now. This all maybe sounds a little bit distant, abstract, even a bit esoteric, but actually, you know, there is, apart from what I described at the beginning, you know, the stages of pranaya, the listening, the reflection, and those kind of gradually deepening into penetration. There's also a sense in which we can access prana, or at least get an intimation of prana through shraddha, through faith, confidence, trust. Hey, and here's an advert. Tuesday night, myself and Pranjit will be going deeper into shraddha. It just happens to be the next topic in the series on the Abhidharma. So be there, be square for a bit more on Shraddha on Tuesday. So Shraddha, it's kind of a glimpse of right vision, of a glimpse of transcendental wisdom. And it's described as unfolding into wisdom. So it's analogous to the unfolding of the intensifiers, culminating in prana. Well, so does Shraddha. And we've described Shraddha as a responsiveness to the truth. Sometimes it's translated as faith, but it's not a belief. It's a responsiveness to the truth, a responsiveness that comes from a confidence. So it's a response with the head. I know this is good. And that has echoes with resolve, doesn't it? The intensifier of resolve. Shraddha also is a response of the heart. So it reaches out to, it is emotionally engaged in. So again, another echo there with emotional engagement and resolve. So Shraddha is a wholehearted response to the truth. And the third aspect of Shraddha that kind of defines Shraddha is commitment, really, is that sense of hands-on. So your confidence and desire manifest as action. So the active dimension of responsiveness is to practice, to engage with the practices, with meditation, with ethics, deepening knowledge of the doctrine, towards attainment, towards that true knowing that is prana. So there's a quote from Sangharachita about this relationship between prana, Shraddha, and prana. He says, and he's actually quoting from Nagarjuna, the third century scholar and brilliant philosopher, Buddhist philosopher. So Nagarjuna says, through Shraddha, one relies on the practices. Through wisdom, one truly knows. Of these two, wisdom is the chief. Shraddha is its prerequisite. So there's this real sense of a trajectory from Shraddha to Prajna. There's also a sense, Buddhism, comes at these different rich concepts like Prajna and Shraddha from different angles. And one of the angles that Buddhism takes is through the spiritual faculties. So you've got a set of basic faculties that we engage when we're going through, when we're developing, when we're growing. So you have faith and wisdom are two kind of complementary faculties that we develop. And there's a sense in which they co-arise. And we need to balance them. We need to bring them into balance, because Shraddha tends to be more focused on the heart, and Prajna tends to be more focused, certainly in this schema of the faculties, the five spiritual faculties, tends to be more focused on the doctrine. And if we can combine those two together, there's a balancing act. But actually, they're inseparable. And one gives rise to the other. They co-arise. They mutually co-arise. Okay, so that's a brief look at penetration or Prajna. It's three levels, and then at its highest level, in the sense of knowledge of the nature of reality, as transcendental insight into the nature of reality, transcending the veils of craving and aversion and of egoistic interpretation, transcendental insight, overcoming the topsy-turvy views of seeing reality as other than it is, the impermanent as permanent, the insubstantial as substantial, painful as pleasurable. And we've looked at how our meditation can mature into those deep absorptions, the absorptions of the wishless, the of shunyata, and the signless, samadhi or absorption. And finally, just we've looked at how by developing our Shraddha, we're getting to grips simultaneously with wisdom, with Prajna. Okay, well, the plan now is, maybe we'll just have a stretch of the legs, but the plan will be to say just 2 minutes, and the plan will be to do a practice of the metta bhavana. I think it's really crucial when we're focusing on wisdom, particularly wisdom in terms of insubstantiality and no fixed self. I think it's crucial to bathe, to immerse these reflections in a sea of metta, loving kindness. Otherwise, the danger is we can flip into a sort of self-negation. So it's best to come at any reflections in this area with positive mental states. And so what we'll do is we'll do a practice now of the metta bhavana. Just a quick leg stretch and a metta bhavana. And we'll proceed after the metta bhavana to a reflection on the three lakshanas as promised. So we'll find our meditation postures, settling down into our bodies. Finding a comfortable position, posture, comfortable and stable. Allowing the posture to be our anchor. Always there for us to come back to whenever we get distracted. An ever-present resource is our body, our physical posture. That ever-present anchor. Anchors us to the seabed, preventing us from going too far off, giving us a bit of stability. How wonderful to have this body to ground us, to anchor us. How wonderful to have the earth beneath us, holding us, whatever we do. So maybe we can just start with a sense of that support being held by the earth and feel those points of contact with the earth, whether it's through the floor or if we are lucky enough to be outside on the earth, that's great, even better. Feeling the pressure points of contact and allowing our weight to drop into those points of support, particularly on the out-breath. Relaxing, releasing, dropping our weight on the gravity. Coming into a more direct experience of our presence in the here and now. The sense of your whole body just here, just now. And I invite you to bring your attention to your heart space, whatever that might mean for you. So a period of metta bhavana, development of loving kindness. wishing ourselves well. May I be well, may I be happy, may I be free from suffering. Really in touch with whatever is going on for us at the moment, in our bodies, in our hearts, in our minds, in our heart minds. Opening up to our experience with a sense of acceptance. Kindly attention. Wishing ourselves well. May we bask in the ease of well-wishing, of kindly attention. bringing to mind a good friend. Making their presence as vivid as we can, maybe remembering their voice, recollecting their face, maybe recollecting a smile on their face as we wish them well. May they be well, may they be happy, may they be free from suffering. May they bask in the light of loving kindness radiating from our hearts. So now bringing to mind a neutral person, again making their presence as vivid as we can, maybe someone we've come across recently. We've had a brief encounter with, maybe, or maybe to someone we've seen from a distance. And we wish them well. We can wish them well through the not knowing. We can wish them well through our common humanity, how much we share, They love and want to be loved, just like us. They want to be happy, just like us. May they be well, may they be happy, may they be free from suffering. We bring to mind now someone we find challenging, a difficult person. And again, we connect with them in as vivid a way as we can. And we wish them well, despite whatever difficulty lies between us. We know that they are far more than our limited view of them. And we share so much more than separates us. So much more unites us. What separates us is superficial. What unites us is profound. May they be well. May they be happy. May they be free from suffering. And we bring to mind ourselves, our friend, the neutral person and the difficult person. And we play with the possibility of having an equal well-wishing towards each of us, unbiased, open, unconditioned. And next, we broaden the scope of our well-wishing to include everyone in our community, our virtual community, here online. May each of us be well and happy in our heart of hearts. And broadening our well-wishing to include people with whom we share the building we're in, if we're in a building, if we're in a field, well, all the living beings that we're sharing the field with. May they be well and happy and free from suffering. And extending beyond the building to the streets, our roads around us, the town, the village, extending out further to the city, if we're in a city, spreading out across the countryside, an ever-increasing radius of well-wishing, crossing the land, bathing all living beings in its way with loving kindness, with well-wishing, whatever they're doing, whether they're working or going for a Sunday walk or sleeping or eating, whatever they're doing, may they be well and happy and free from suffering. As our circle extends out beyond the country to include other countries, a whole continent, all beings, whether humans or animal or plant, all living beings, may they all be well and happy and free from suffering. Extending completely around the globe and beyond into the universe, may all beings, wheresoever they are, be well and happy and free from suffering. And we'll gently transition from the metta bhavana into a reflection on the three lakshanas, the three marks of conditioned existence, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, insubstantiality. The Buddha says, all conditioned things are impermanent. Who realizes this is freed from suffering. This is the path. And we see impermanence all around us, every minute of our lives. It is evident in all our experience, in the weather, 1 minute sunny, the next cloudy. Sometimes freezing, sometimes just above. And suddenly it seems to be 10 degrees warmer. We experience impermanence in our possessions. When we break things, when we wear that favorite item of clothing until it's threadbare, we go for a walk, we maybe into the park, noticing the changes in the trees and the grass. We experience nature as our teacher in impermanence, as the seasons progress, as the snowdrops come and go, followed quickly by daffodils, that rich harvest of yellowness. We experience the days lengthening as spring gathers pace. More intimately, we experience impermanence in our thoughts, in our emotions. They come. We don't know from where, and they go. We don't know where to. They arise and they fall. Our best thoughts, our worst thoughts, our happiest emotions, our darkest emotions, all of them. They arise, they stay, and they pass. As the Buddha says, whatever has by nature an origin has by nature an end. We can observe this impermanence of our mental experience all the more through our meditation. And then we have that intimate experience of impermanence in and through our bodies. How we change. Perhaps we're aging. We notice a change in the color of our hair. Maybe we lose an occasional tooth. Maybe we notice the physical abilities of our youth diminishing. I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. This body is impermanent. Ready or not, one day I shall die. This life I must know as the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. And we reflect on unsatisfactoriness, the second of the lakshanas. The Buddha says, all conditioned things are unsatisfactory. Who realizes this is freed from suffering. This is the path. And this unsatisfactoriness, of course, is partly rooted in the impermanence of conditioned existence. So whatever we turn to for pleasure, for security, for a sense of identity, it all must cease, it all must end. It is impermanent. These cannot provide lasting happiness, a security, or a fixed identity. And yet, we form unrealistic expectations. The truth is, it must be parted from all of these things in life of which I expect so much. Even if I don't have unrealistic expectations, there is still unsatisfactoriness or dukkha. As long as I have a body, dukkha is unavoidable. Being subject to illness, to old age, to stumping my toe, being subject to heat, and cold, being subject to pain. This all comes with having a body. And then I add to this inevitable, unavoidable dukkha through resisting the inevitable change. Through denial, through blame, through resentment. I close down on the reality. And yet there is so much I can learn from the experience of dukkha. It can point to my attachments, to my wrong views, to my destructive habits. Dukkha can be my teacher. Dukkha can be my friend. And moving on to the Lakshana, the mark of existence, the third lakshana of insubstantiality or non-self. The Buddha says, all conditioned things lack a separate self. Who realizes this is freed from suffering. This is the path. So this is the teaching of no fixed, separate, isolated, independent self. How much of our mental activity is based on the sense of an autonomous, stable self that is our pilot in life, in control. I'm in control. And yet, where is the I? Where can we find this self? We look at our experience and we can't find the I. Not in the body, not in our consciousness, not in our sensations, not in our thoughts, not in our emotions. They all come and go, and There's this apparent I still there. The body changes. We change our hairstyle, our clothes. The body, the self is not there. Maybe the self is in the habits, our behavioral habits, our habits of views, the way we see the world, our opinions. Perhaps in the stories that we tell ourselves. And yet how these change, chop and change with time. Can we drop the stories? Can we follow the advice of the Buddha to Bahia when he says, in the seen, only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the cognized, only the cognized. No need for a self in the picture. Maybe you experience that. Maybe a sense of joy, and you don't really need the I. The I seems to come in after the fact, after the experience of the joy, after the experience of sadness, after the decision. An I is invoked. But is it necessary? Vasubandhu says, no doer of the deed is found, no one who ever reaps their fruits. Just bare phenomena roll on. The truth is, we are profoundly interconnected with the world. The world is a continuous flow of processes, and we are a flow of processes within that wider world of processes. We're an eddy within the stream, distinct but not separate. Constantly changing, but without any real boundaries between us and the stream. Just bare phenomena roll on. an infinite blue sky. Pure and empty are all events. Pure and empty am I. All is pure and empty as infinite blue sky. An infinite blue sky. Pure and empty are all events. Pure and empty am I. All is pure and empty. An infinite blue sky. Pure and empty are all events. Pure and empty am I. Is pure and empty, an infinite blue sky. Pure and empty are all events. Pure and empty am I. All is pure and empty, an infinite blue sky. Pure and empty are all events. Pure am I. All is pure and empty, an infinite blue sky. Pure and empty are all events. Pure and empty am I. All is pure and empty, an infinite blue sky. As infinite blue sky, as infinite blue sky. So that concludes our session this morning. I hope you have a restful and mindful time in between now and our next session at 4 o'clock, and you have a nourishing lunch in between, maybe a few breaths of fresh air out there in certainly a bright day here. Lovely to spend the morning with you and ponder non-self, to ponder the lakshanas, to ponder pranya, the great goal of the Buddha's path. And yes, look forward to joining you again at 4 o'clock, and we will round things up and conclude our retreat. So go well in between times.
Thank you, Adam and Dave, that was very potent. I'd be grateful if you